Okay, so my name is Dallin Gazinski. I work with the National Center for Employee Ownership. Any employee-owned companies in the room? A few. Oh, wow. Nice. All right. So I typically work primarily with employee-owned companies. Occasionally, I work outside of the employee-owned community. As you know, SRC is part of the employee-owned community. They're a big part of it, given that they do a lot of what they're doing here for the employee ownership community. So a lot of their presentations are done at some of our conferences. But if you'd like to know more about employee ownership itself, there's quite a few people. Yeah? Oh, okay. Okay, so if you'd like to know more about employee ownership itself and its relationship to the great game of business, I'd be happy to talk to you about that. There's a few other people at this conference this week that I'm also very close with, that work closely with employee-owned businesses. But it's hopefully something that you eventually become curious about, because we're certainly trying to talk a lot more about it. Now, what do I do? I work with those companies to help them develop what we call ownership cultures. I'm the director of culture and engagement at the NCEO. I'm a speaker. I do employee surveys. I do this session at a lot of company events. People tend to like it. It's a little bit fun and lighthearted, so I'm glad that you guys are here to start the day off with this. So, you know, because hopefully you get something out of this that you can just take and utilize in other sessions, or maybe even when you're out having drinks later. You want to be careful, though, when using these rules and with drink in hand. Okay, so improv for business. What are we even talking about? Who's familiar with comedic improv, theatric improv? What's the first thing you think about when you think improv?
Yes,
and? Yes, and? Who? Michael Scott. Yep, what's that? Colin Mochrie. SNL, whose line is it anyway, right? A lot of SNL characters or actors, we're talking, I mean, you name it, right? All of these guys came up through comedic improv. A lot of them learned at a place called Second City in Chicago, okay? And in order to do comedic improv, you need to create radical trust among your teammates, because anything can come out of a crowd. They're literally soliciting the crowd for ideas on what the scene that they're about to do is going to have in it, right? I've seen a scene where somebody asked for, you know, give us a common kitchen appliance, and somebody said a giraffe. And they just had to go with it. They went with a giraffe and started the scene with a giraffe in their kitchen. Okay, like, so it gets wacky, right? And you never know what's going to come out of the audience. You never know what's going to come out of your partner's mouth, but you've got to respond effectively to it, right? And the only way to do that and do it comfortably and with confidence is to create radical trust and reciprocity between your teammates. Okay, so we're going to talk about some of the rules that comedians like these guys use to do improv more effectively, okay? Now, I want to start with a story from The Great Game of Business. Everybody read the book? Who's read the book? Who's read the book? Okay, so a lot of you have read the book, and early in the book, there's this story about iron workers going on strike, and they're not able to get the materials that they need to do their work, because the vehicles that are transporting these materials are being shot at. You remember that story? Okay. Does anybody remember the solution to that very serious problem? Nuns driving a school bus, right? First they say, well, what if we put it all in school buses, and then they ask, well, will they shoot at school buses? And somebody else says, well, what won't they shoot at? Another person says, nuns. So they put nuns in school, but they dress up as nuns, and get into school buses and transport their materials. And what is, I mean, this is high stakes, right? This is not a, it's funny story, but it's not really a laughing matter. We're talking jobs, right? People can't go to work if they can't get this done. Now, that's a crazy, crazy solution to a very serious problem, right? Now, what if people just, if somebody had suggested school buses and the group or somebody in the group was just adamant that school buses wouldn't work? Nope, that's not going to work. That's crazy. Why would we put school buses? No, that's not going to happen. Nuns? Are you kidding me? We're going to dress up as nuns, right? Had they not created radical trust and psychological safety and just tried it out, they might not have solved a very serious problem, right? Now, what's funny, Jack Stack was actually in the room last year, and I told that story, and he chimed in, and he said, you know, we were all drunk in a bar when we came up with those ideas at the time. Maybe we're a little bit more agreeable in bars. I don't know. But but what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a setting and an environment where we can deal with serious problems and affirm one another and try to build on each other's wacky ideas. We want to let ideas breathe, right? So we're doing improv in every aspect of what we do day in, day out, whether it be work, whether you're just talking to a stranger, all right? You're creating every single day when you enter into conversation with someone. You're adapting to people's different personality types, like we were talking about earlier, Rich, right? So improv allows us to adapt, right, a little bit more effectively. Where do we use it? In work? I mean, strategy, building strategy, your marketing, making improvements to your various work practices, innovation and brainstorming. This is especially important, right? But most important is in the context of teamwork, okay? So I want to talk a little bit about teamwork, and there's a lot of good research on what makes teams more or less effective, okay? And some of the seminal research that was recently confirmed by the research that Google did on their own work teams, some of the seminal research on effective teams was from Amy Edmondson, okay? Now, Amy Edmondson was actually studying work teams in the context of hospitals and specifically surgical procedures, okay? Now, what she anticipated was that the surgical teams that found the most mistakes or were making the most mistakes were going to be the ones that were least effective. What her research actually found, which was kind of surprising to her, was that the work teams that were identifying the most mistakes over the course of their work were actually the teams that were the most effective and the teams that prevented the most disasters, okay, in the context of their work. Why was this? Well, one, there was enough psychological safety on the team for people that were in positions that weren't even the head surgeon, you know, maybe nurses or people working under the head surgeon. There was enough psychological safety on the team for them to say, wait, are you sure about this? Is this correct? Is this the right diagnosis? Is this the correct procedure, right? Okay, they felt comfortable and safe enough to correct even their higher-ups or, you know, identify mistakes and not feel so fearful, right? Who has ever had a boss that was making a questionable decision and, you know, you felt a little uncomfortable about addressing it, You ever had that happen, right? I mean, it can happen in any context, even with a colleague, right? If you don't have psychological safety, you can't have these conversations very comfortably, right? So what she found was that the work teams that had the highest level of involvement from every team member and were creating norms that allowed for more psychological safety were the ones that were most successful. Now, Google recently did this research, and I'd be happy to, you know, I want you to guys get my contact information at the end. I'd be happy to send you the New York Times article that talks about this. But Google did similar research on their own work teams, and what did they find? They found the same exact thing that Amy Edmondson was finding in her research back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. The teams that had the most psychological safety were the ones that were more effective. It wasn't collective IQ. It wasn't having the person with the highest IQ, the most leaders versus fewer leaders. It was their group norms, okay? Now, what are the barriers to these things? Typically, when it comes to high involvement, it's a lack of structure, right? So a lot of what you guys are going to be doing this week is going to be all about creating structure for higher levels of involvement. That's really what the great game does really well, right? Business literacy, high level of involvement. Now, when it comes to psychological safety, one of the biggest barriers is fear, right? I mean, this is just, it's just fear of how people may perceive you, right? So I want you to move forward a little faster now. I want you to think about this. When have you felt the most fear when it comes to expressing yourself openly, failure or making mistakes, or feeling acknowledged or accepted? When have you felt the most fear when it comes to those things? I'm going to need your help on this one.
When I feel I'm going to be criticized.
In what context? Any context, right? I mean, yeah. Whether it be in work, school, you name it, right? Right. Fear of criticism. What other environments?
When my mistakes can affect others negatively.
Right. Especially in a work group, right? Fear of making mistakes is a huge one. And rule number four, we're going to address that later. It's going to be the last one.
Questioning a well-established
Boom, that's a huge one, right? Questioning a well-established principle, right? This happened a lot for me in grad school. I tried to do it all the time. They didn't take kindly to it. What were you going
to
say?
I was going to say losing credibility to a superior.
Losing credibility to a superior, maybe via making a mistake or something that happens in the workplace. What about outside the workplace? There's a lack of trust. Maybe you don't know people, right? Maybe even at a party, you might feel a little fear about this. You know, where you're the stranger, the odd man out. Everybody else knows each other, right? Any others? You got one?
Expressing yourself openly would be when you know that person's not going to hear you.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe just talking about politics, right, or what's going on in the world, right? We're kind of fearful of that. Yeah.
Ooh. You're fearful that you're going to confirm that story.
Say that louder. You're going deep.
Yeah?
Telling a story you're telling yourself
about how they feel.
About how they feel.
That you confirm that.
Whoa.
You self-fulfill it.
Right. That's a good one. You know what? You know when I feel the most fear or have felt a lot of fear is when I go to meet the girlfriend's parents. I dated a girl once whose dad was a drill sergeant. That's scary, okay? Okay, so when do you feel the least amount of fear when it comes to those things? What context?
Familiar surroundings,
right? Most familiar surrounding for me is with my family.
Safety,
right? At the dinner table. I feel like I can express myself openly with my parents and my sister, maybe a little too openly sometimes, right? What else?
When I'm fully prepared for all the questions that are
coming up. Yeah, when I'm fully prepared, right? you know, like when you're comfortable with the content of your speech or something, right? That's always a good one, right? When it makes you feel a little more confident, right? With your friends, perhaps. What else?
When you have trust.
When you have trust. When, I mean, this is especially important in your relationship maybe with your significant other, right? And I would encourage you as we go through these rules, think about not just these rules in the context of your work, but in the context of your relationships, whether they be your friends, what have you. Go ahead. Yeah,
when you're passionate about it.
Especially when you're passionate about it, right? Okay, so here are the rules. Rule number one, okay? Agree, don't deny. So we're going to put, I'll put these up here multiple times. We're going to go through them slowly. So rule number one, agree, non-denial, all right? So this is super important in improv because if I'm on a stage and I and somebody says, you know, the man has a gun, and I say, that's not a gun, that's an apple. That whole scene goes nowhere, right? It stops dead in its tracks. So rule number one is that you whatever I say, you've got to agree. If I say I've got a gun, you've got to agree, all right, he's got a gun. Now where do we go with this scene, right? So it's important to postpone judgment. Okay, and what I mean by this is that remember the Jack Stack story. Okay, these were wacky ideas. What did they do? This was a practice of non-denial, right? They postponed judgment. They allowed those ideas to breathe to see where they go. Okay, so this is the fun part. We're going to do a little exercise to illustrate what I mean by what denial can do. To just about anything. And we're going to simplify it, okay? You're going to partner up. You need a partner for this. Just, you know, pick a buddy, okay? You guys are going to have a conversation. I want the person with the bigger shoe size to start the conversation, okay? All right. You're going to have a conversation. Wait. Hold up. I've got rules for you. I've got rules. You've got to follow my rules, all right? Hold on. I know you're excited. I know. You're going to have a conversation about where you want to go on vacation, but there's only one rule. You can only respond to each other by starting every sentence with yes, but. Okay? So the person with the bigger shoe size is going to make a suggestion. I want to go to Panama, okay? And the partner is going to respond, yes, but Panama this year, this time of year is really humid. I'm not so sure I like that. And then you're going to respond with yes, but, and it's going to go back and forth. I'm going to let you do this for no more than 30, 60 seconds, okay? It's going to go by really fast. It's not going to be painful, guys, I promise. All right? Okay, so remember, one person's going to start the conversation with a suggestion, and you're only allowed to respond with yes, but. Ready, go. Okay, so how'd we do? How'd we do, guys?
You ain't going.
You ain't going on vacation. I think maybe you just made an enemy, if anything, right? So the first response... appropriate answer to the second question. What are the consequences? We ain't going, right? So that's probably the most important consequence. Absolutely nothing comes of that conversation. What do you feel? What kind of emotions do you feel? What is the interaction like?
Not supportive.
You don't feel supportive. It's antagonistic, right? What else?
Kills the excitement.
Kills the excitement. That's a good one.
You kind of hit a wall.
You hit a wall over and over and over again. You're like banging your head against the wall, right?
You get into a loop.
Yeah, it's just, you're talking in circles, right? You could go on like that for days, and the more and more you do it, the more frustrating it becomes, the more tiresome it becomes, right? The less engaged you become.
There was a clear winner.
It's oftentimes, it's one person constantly trying to defend themselves, right? You're putting people on the defense when all you say is no or yes, but, or that won't work because of this, you know, right? So the point of rule number one is to create a space where we put that sort of tendency of ours to edit, we put that to the side for a minute, okay? We postpone judgment, and then we move. Once you've created that space, you can edit later. Maybe Antarctica isn't quite feasible, okay? But we'll get there, all right? Once we look at our budget, maybe, okay? But postpone judgment and move on to rule number two, okay? Rule number two is the most important rule in improv, the yes and rule, okay? And I hope to hear some of you using it throughout the day, all right? Let's get back to our vacation, because the yes and rule is pretty straightforward. The person with the smaller shoe size is going to make the suggestion, okay? Get as creative as you want with this one, guys. This is what this is for, okay? Pick the wackiest place, challenge yourself, all right? This time you're going to have the same conversation, but you're going to use the rule yes and, all right? And you're only allowed to respond to your partner with a yes and, okay? So no more than 60 seconds, new location entirely, and let's see where we go, all right? Yes and. All right, how we doing? All right. Question number one. Are we going on vacation? Yes. How many people are going on two vacations? Every time this happens, I end up with folks that are like, well, yeah, since we're in Thailand, maybe we should hit up Cambodia and Laos on the way. And Australia's not too far. We're in that hemisphere. Let's go. Right? So, show of hands, how many people did actually go on two vacations? Yes, of course this happened, right? So, but most importantly, we're going somewhere, right? What else happens? What else? What's different about this experience?
Energy.
Yeah. Describe that for me.
So immediately we were smiling rather than just kind of like, oh, but it was, oh, we got excited. There was
high fives. Yeah. Yeah. Give your partner a high five, everyone. Boom. All right. You're automatically going, right? Your whole demeanor changes. At one point, somebody told me my body language was different. Initially, I was just like, oh, gosh, slumping in my chair. And this time, I'm leaning forward, and the dynamic is just totally different. So that's a good one, the energy that you feel, right? You're being propelled forward.
I'm just saying, I couldn't wait to get my next suggestion.
Yeah, you're leaning in. It's way more exciting, right? You become way more engaged in the process, and you want to come up with more ideas, right? Just to see where it goes, right? Go ahead.
It just felt like this, you know, you're trying to build a fire together instead of somebody just pouring water on it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, or You know, speaking of building fires, I mean, I just went camping 2 weeks ago with strangers, which is something that I never do, right? I do not often go with strangers because we go with friends that we trust. And when you're building a fire, people need to pitch in, right? So that was our first rule. When we get to campsite, nobody's sitting around. Everybody's got to pitch in, right? You got to do your part. Yes, and can we make, even when building a fire, right? We're creating high levels of involvement and trust. I can trust that you're going to pitch in when I need you, right? So what else? What else do you feel?
There's a lot of agreement.
I mean, 100%, right? You're making the rule that you agree, right? So agreement and you're building, right? So there's not just agreement, but you're also entrusting your partner with the next step in the process, right? And that's what improv is. Improv is, we're going to get to the next rule, but the next rule is really all about that. You've got to entrust your partners with support, right? They're going to support whatever comes out of your mouth, and whatever wacky thing I say, you're going to respond to. Anything else? Yeah. We'll come back to you next. What's up?
You get somewhere you wouldn't expect to go.
Yeah, right. I mean, this is. Anybody heard of the book Where Good Ideas Come From? No? Okay, well, write it down. I was hoping at least one person knew about it. But this is something that is discussed in the book. A lot of eureka ideas are the culmination of a series of other ideas, right? Interacting with one another, right? So the more, again, getting back to the high involvement component of all this, the more people you have involved, the more perspectives, experiences, and mindsets, you'll get somewhere you might not have expected, right? I'm going to put that story on pause, but we're going to come back. Remind me to come back to this when it comes to rule number 4. You were going to say something.
I was just going to say that instead of hitting walls, the conversation travels.
Yeah, it's constantly propelling itself forward, right? Even if where you get seems unfeasible, right? You can lay it all out there, and once you've got it all out there, you can sort of then take a step back and edit, right? Now you can say, well, maybe 3 countries isn't so within our budget. Maybe we can only do 2 of these, but at least we're going to do 2, right? So this is a fundamentally different experience, okay? And this is an exercise that you guys can do in the workplace. You can take this back and just do it at your next staff meeting, right? Just to illustrate why these sort of interactions are kind of important to remember, right? Because when you start interacting, you know, with your colleagues, and there's a constant yes but sort of norm being created, you want to take a step back, put things on pause, and say, well, hold on. We've got to reassess, you know, the kind of interactions that are happening right now, because they might not get us to where we want to be. Okay? Let me check the time real quick. All right. Okay, so it's an additive approach. It enables involvement, and it affirms what your partner is creating. It's creating affirmation, right? Which is, man, how many people feel good when that's what they're feeling? Go ahead.
So I got a question.
Yeah.
My partner suggested we go to Alaska.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, I said yes.
Yeah, yeah.
What if I don't want to go to Alaska?
Well, that's the point. I mean, you
schedule it 50 years from now.
Yes. Well, see, if you don't, I mean, the point is that you want to go on vacation, right? And you want to get, you want to create a space where you two can actually go on vacation together. And if you're creating a dynamic where all you're doing is nitpicking at what is wrong with why a person wants to go to Alaska, do you think you're going to create a relationship that'll make any vacation fun?
I can already hear it.
You said yes. So, I mean, here's the point. Maybe Alaska isn't your ideal vacation, okay? But let's think about it in the context of problem solving, okay? And in the context of problem solving, the problem needs to get solved, right? Now, there might be multiple approaches to solving that problem, okay? And if the team dynamic is one based on a series of yes buts, you're going to sit there and you're going to constantly edit, and nitpick why every idea won't work. And an hour later, you'll have absolutely nothing. Now, if you create, you'll have nothing but critiques, right? Now, if you create a space where you postpone judgment just temporarily, okay, non-denial, and you try to take the more additive approach, you can get all of your ideas out there, all of the potential solutions on the board, right? And then you can take a step back and say, well, to be quite honest, I don't know if Alaska's going to work for me. Maybe you should find a different, you know, a different travel buddy. But the point is that you want to be efficient with your time. And if you constantly edit right off the bat, and you critique, you may be missing out on a series of other solutions, or you may be missing out on somebody responding to another person's idea in a way that gives you the best solution, right? So you want to build on each other. It's really about that process, right? But I get what you're saying. I understand. Maybe you don't want to go to Alaska. That's.
I would be like, yeah, so tell me more about what you want to see in Alaska.
There you go. That's
maybe
a good.
You want, like, I want the trees. I want the mountains. And say, oh, yeah. And have you considered Canada?
There you go. Can, yeah, maybe it becomes a persuasive a point of persuasion. Okay. You know what? I'm going to, okay, well, actually, you know what? I want to talk a little bit about employee ownership. One of the things that I do often is, in my surveying, is I ask people, how much do you feel like an owner of this company, okay? Now, technically, they're all owners, right? Once they start to get stock into their accounts, they technically own a little piece of the business, right? But getting someone to feel like an owner is a totally different animal, all right? People bring their own sort of expectations, experiences, you know, sense of meaning to that word, ownership, right? Oftentimes it has a lot more to do with the experience that they have in work, as opposed to just owning stock, okay? You'll see. So these are responses based on a question. How much do you feel like an owner of this company? Okay, and the question is on a 10-point scale, not at all, at the low end, to very much, 10 out of 10. Right? Now you'll see the database. For this, this is our entire database. There's something like, you know, 28,000 employee responses to this question. Around 40 to 50% of the employees feel some meaningful sense of ownership. All right, but the other 50 50-55% are either on the fence or don't feel like owners at all. Okay? Now, these two companies are real companies. Okay? You'll note that company A, less than 10% of the employees at this company felt like owners. Okay? 36%, somewhere in the middle, on the fence, and more than 50% did not feel like owners at all. Okay? Now, company B, one of the highest scores we've ever seen, more than 70%, this is the highest score I've ever seen, okay? More than 70% feel that ownership is meaningful to them. They, when asked, how much do you feel like an owner? They feel like owners. 0% don't feel like owners. And then 29% are on the fence. That's pretty typical. You're probably talking, I mean, a lot of these people may be, you know, 1-2 years into the company, right? Now, what if I were to tell you there's a maximum on the contributions a company can make to 401k and ESOP accounts, all right? And it's 25% payroll. Now, what if I were to tell you that one of these companies was maxing out their contributions to their ESOP and 401k, maxing it out, putting as much as they can into the ESOP and their 401k accounts. Which company would you think? Yeah, it's a trick question, right? But it's company A. Company A was maxing out employer contributions to their ESOP and 401k, right? The difference between company A and company B is that company B spent 12 years trying to listen to employee feedback, trying to understand how employees felt, right? And when they got that feedback, they took it serious. They created a formal process where the board would review their survey feedback, and then they would hold leadership accountable to responding to that feedback effectively, right? The worst thing a company can do when you survey employees is no, or yeah, but, right? That's the worst thing you can do, because what it does is it shows employees that you're not taking their feedback seriously, right? That you don't really want to respond. And if you can't respond effectively, what you're going to do is you're going to create a company like Company A, where people don't feel like, regardless of how much stock you're throwing at them, they don't really feel like you're taking them seriously or their major concerns seriously, right? So that's why it's so important to create a culture where people feel involved and engaged and feel like they can trust you, especially when it comes to giving feedback or receiving feedback, right? Okay, so rule number three. This rule varies. I got there's two sides of the coin. Support the team, make statements. Now, it's most important to support the team, right? What I mean by make statements is that if you constantly nitpick and ask people, you know, if you constantly put people on the defensive, right, where you're just asking them a series of questions and you're putting all of the pressure on one person to make all of the decisions, whether it be the leader or a team leader or somebody that's, you know, proposing a new project, okay? When too much pressure is put on one person, that's when burnout occurs, okay? So you need to create an environment where your team members support the team, that you're not too quick to edit. You create room where the pressure isn't just on one person, right? Like we were saying earlier, it can feel like you're constantly on the defensive, right? We want to create an environment where that doesn't exist, okay? All right, so we've got about 10-15 minutes left, and I want to get to another one of my favorite rules. In improv, there are no mistakes. Kitchen appliance, somebody says giraffe, we're running with it, right? So this is what is meant by there are no mistakes. Are there mistakes in work? Yes. Do we fail? Yes. It's inevitable, right? This is more about there are no there are no mistakes mindset, okay? And we're going to, for instance, Thomas Edison, I have not failed, I just found 10,000 ways that won't work, all right? And this is what is kind of meant by there are no mistakes in improv, all right? Regardless of what comes out, as we're working through this, we're going to go somewhere. We're going to respond. We're not going to let this stop us in our tracks, okay? And this is really, really important because earlier on, we were talking about fear of making mistakes or failure, right, and what that can do. We want to create a work environment where risk is okay. Failure is okay. Sometimes mistakes can lead to really, really great breakthroughs, all right? Great game myth number two, nice guys finish last, right? Jack Stack says himself, it's the good guy managers that are going to finish first, right? And if you're constantly playing the blame game and constantly making people feel like their mistakes have ruined the company, you're not going to create an environment where people want to keep going, right? That get excited about keep, you know, moving forward regardless of what wacky thing might be coming of whatever you're doing, right? Great game myth number three, a manager's job is to come up with all the answers. Not true, right? Sometimes managers need to rely on their team, okay? And if a manager's going to rely on their team, managers need to enable, you need to enable your people to take risks, to do it on their own, to make mistakes on occasion, right? And when people make mistakes, it's got to be the dust it off mentality. These are learning opportunities, okay? Because according to Jack Stack, in the great game of business, what must every good manager do? Build confidence in other people. And to do that, you have to show people you're human, you're not God, you don't have all the answers, you make a lot of mistakes, right? We got to be humble. As work teams, as managers, as colleagues, we're going to make mistakes, we're going to be human, right? So rather than, oh, geez, what are we going to do now? Respond very, very differently when it comes to mistakes. There are no mistakes. What is this? This is a learning opportunity, okay? So this is going to be a group discussion, so not just two people. You can turn around. It can be four or five. So if each set of rows could maybe turn around into a group and form a group of five or six people, I want you guys to have a conversation, okay? And I want you to think back on a time where you or your team experienced failure, all right? And I want you to think of this in the context of work, not in your everyday life. Think of it in the context of your work. It can be your team. It can be your company, maybe your leadership team, whatever you want. Think back on a time where you and your team experienced failure, and I want you to try to extract two or three different positive outcomes from that experience, okay? I want you to have multiple conversations right now. I'm going to give you 5 to 10 minutes. But really think back on a big failure, you know, challenge yourself or a big mistake, and then hopefully you were able to respond and create some actual value from whatever that mishap was, all right? So have that. I'm going to give you a few minutes to have those conversations, and then we're going to come back, and hopefully we're going to share some of those, all right? All right. See, it's therapy, isn't it? It's kind of therapeutic talking about all the mistakes that we've made. Little. Okay, I want to know, though, who has a really striking mistake to success story. Anybody? Were there any really, really good ones? Some juicy mistakes that turned into really, really valuable outcomes? You got
it was a mistake, but it was a failure.
It was a failure. Failure or mistake? Which, who?
My name is Don. I'm with SRC, and I was just thinking back to when I first joined the company, which was August of 86, right at the time where the publication came out. And when we did that, it was at that time just the 13 employee owners, the managers that started the business, plus the ESOP. And as soon as I started, we did a stock rights offering to all the employees, and you could buy into the company and own individual shares. Well, they did that and raised quite a bit of money. And at that point in time, we had a significant contract with General Motors that we were doing the diesel engines for them. I don't know if any of you guys are old enough to remember diesel engines in cars for GM, but nonetheless, we had that contract, and we were essentially printing money at that point in time. Well, it wasn't 2 or 3 months after all that had happened that a court case came down that essentially rendered our contract null and void, that GM no longer had to supply these engines to the aftermarket. And just like that, our contract was cut off. So not only did we go from a highly profitable company to now one that's losing money, and we just raised a whole bunch of money from the employee owners. And what came of it is the fact that it really solidified our culture because we didn't lay people off. People would take time off to help balance things, and we got into new businesses. So yeah. It worked out.
Boom. You were resilient, yeah. Agile.
Yeah.
Right? And that's what this is all about. I mean, this is what we're talking about, right? It's resiliency and agility in the face of serious adversity, right? And sometimes the best thing that, I think like you said, sometimes the best thing that comes from those, I mean, it's not even necessarily a failure. It's just you fall on hard times. Sometimes the best thing that comes of it is the, you know, resilience or the transformation that your culture can experience, right? Anybody else got any good ones to tell? If not, I can go ahead.
All right, so this is actually more of a little bit of improv based on conversation that naturally occurred here. Uh-huh. But gentlemen, both of them sitting next to me, were talking about trimming a pear tree. And what's interesting, what I gathered from that conversation, was a fruit-bearing tree is not a tree that you really want to leave pretty. You make the tree pretty, you mask what it is, all of a sudden it doesn't bear fruit anymore. But you leave it as is, you let it grow as it will, you're honest about what it is, and it will continue to produce fruit. And I think that's an important lesson to take and apply that to business.
Yeah, I like that one. Yeah, nicely done, guys. Way to bring the poetry into the conversation. I like it. We were getting deep earlier. This is a good group. Anybody familiar with the story of the Post-it note? 3M? Post-it note is one of the biggest mistake stories in American business. Spencer Silver in the late 1960s is working for 3M, and he's tasked with creating a super, super strong aerospace adhesive, okay? And all he's coming up with is this really lightweight adhesive that kind of sticks to things, but it's not really a super strong adhesive. The only characteristic that's kind of notable about it is that when you pull it off, it doesn't leave any sticky residue on whatever surface you put it on, right? And Spencer Silver he's failing miserably, right? He's not completing his task. But he doesn't really let go of this lightweight adhesive, right? And he does various presentations over the years at 3M, and he's kind of forced to shelf it. But 3M has, I think they call it a bootleg policy, or so it's a you can you can look at other ideas that people have had or things that others have been working on and then, you know, maybe take it off the shelf and take a look at it. Arthur Fry is that man. Arthur Fry looks at this lightweight adhesive and he happens to apply it to bookmarks that he's using in his hymnals at church. Okay? And he thinks to himself, well, there's something in this. And what happens over the next few years is that they develop a product that they then market test that turns into Post-its. And Post-its becomes one of their top-selling, most profitable products of all time. And it all started with the failure to create a super, super strong adhesive, right? But what do they do? They let that idea breathe for the better part of a decade, right? And again, getting back to what you were saying, right? You don't know where that idea is going to go. But sometimes somebody else can bring their own experience, their own ideas to the conversation, and voila, you have something pretty amazing, right? That you didn't expect to have when you started. So that's really what this is all about, guys. The four rules, hopefully you find them applicable in your workplace, when you're out having conversations at lunch. Again, remember, always be careful when at the bar and somebody hands you a beer, use yes and in moderation, okay? Yes and, support your teammates. There are no mistakes. We're out of time. You know, it's lunchtime. We can ask some questions now. I want to put my email up there. Are there any questions at the end of the day? No? Well, thank you guys all for coming. I'd be happy to talk to you over the next 2 days. It's really great being here. So.
Make sure you guys do your evals. If you need a paper one, let me know. Also, they are on the app. If you do the concurrent session one, you can scroll down. Dallin's information is also there for you to get a hold of him with any questions you guys have. Yep. So.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.